Welcome into another episode of That's
So Cincinnati.
Silent Phil on the ones and twos, Jason Williams along with my co-host and friend, Sherry Coolidge. Sherry, here we are.
Here we are. We're getting ready to wrap up the year. Three more episodes.
I'll tell you, this is it seems like we're sprinting here toward the end of the year as we're trying to work on all of our episodes. We have some really fun. I think we have some fun things planned here for our holiday episodes the next couple weeks. And, you know, scrambling to get stories done and columns done and get a little rest and relaxation in before the big 2020 election year. As Carl told me this morning as we were recording this on Tuesday, I had our Carl Weiser, who our regular listeners know is our politics editor. He and I had our one-on-one meeting this morning, and he said, you know, make sure you get some good rest over the holidays here because it's going to be intense in 2020, and early voting starts in whatever he said, February. I think it's February 18th.
I think that too, and there's a lot of races to cover, but at the same time, there's actually a lot of very important stories going on right now at the city and the county level, and those are going to need just as much as attention as the actual races of who's going to be, you know, in charge going forward. So it's just I see it as a lot too.
I'm glad you brought that up, Sherry, because one of those important stories you just posted today on Cincinnati.com, and it's about Cincinnati City Councilwoman Tamaya Denard, who is how do I explain this? She did not disclose some, you know, owing money to a creditor on her ethics filing to the state. And, you know, to take this, I'm just sitting here stumbling. This is your story and you've done a great job on it, and talk about what the story is and what it means. And
I came across it by accident. And honestly, I put a lot of thought into whether this is the story that I wanted to tell right now. I was combing through some court records looking for some things related to the text messaging case. Mm-hmm. And I noticed that, you know, there were a lot of debts in Tamaya Denard's court records. And something I think, you know, this is important, this going back to our last topic, right? As we cover these races going forward, yep, these background checks and who these people are and telling their stories are so very important. It's not enough to do it afterwards, you know, learning, yep, things about candidates, you know, after they're already elected. These stories need to be told at the front end of things. And so I kind of came across the idea, something that each candidate must do around May, is file a financial disclosure form. These are very lengthy forms where people need to put their investments and their debts. And they're meant to provide transparency so there's never a conflict of interest, mm-hmm, to say, well, if you're investing in this, you know, company, well, that company shouldn't be doing business with the city that you're voting on. And it's just sunshine and transparency. And I looked at all of those records back in May, and honestly, there was hardly anything on them, and you never saw a story about it. Council members who you think might have some investments have investments, and they're listed on there. And there wasn't really a whole lot of debt on the debt side. We're talking over $1,000, credit cards, anything you really owe money to. And so I just kind of set it aside and was like, I thought it was surprising to me, to be honest, that nobody really had things like that. But I was like, okay, whatever. They're still sitting on my desk. This is why, mm-hmm, the things kind of encroach over to you, Jason. They get out of hand. And so when I noticed that these debts in the court system, I knew that they hadn't been disclosed. And I thought, you know, is this a story? And I had, you know, big conversations with my Carl, our direct editor, and, you know, a lot of people at the newspaper about whether this is a story I needed to tell. Mm-hmm. But to be honest, Tamaya is a city councilwoman, and she also, you know, she could be running for council next time. This is her first term now. There's rumors that she could run for mayor. And I felt like vetting these things in real time instead of waiting till the week before the election and then writing these kind of big wrap-up stories. I was like, I just felt like real time was more important. When you find something, you write it. And that's where this kind of came from. And she does, you know, she has debts over $1,000 that were not disclosed on this report. That, you know, that's not allowed. And these reports could not be more clear. They're very easy to understand. List any deaths from, you know, the prior 12 months period that we're reporting for here.
Yeah.
it's a list. It's like...
I want to ask you... I want to say something, get your thought on it, and then I want to ask you something about the politics of it. When I read your story, great work. This is what you do, and what you do best is watchdog reporting. You're as fair gets. You're committed to the truth. I know you've worked really hard on this story to be thorough in vetting of it, talking to a lot of people. You sat down with Tamaya herself. She declined comment. I have so much respect for that. What I want to say is my thoughts on when I see a story like this is this is an important story because these are elected officials. It doesn't matter if they're Democrat or Republican or independent or none of the above. What matters is this tells the public who are voting for this person or not voting for that person how they may be in office. What can you trust that person when they're in office? And my take on something like this is if someone who is running for office or in office has their own personal finances are in a mess or in disarray, and we also know that there are public officials, elected officials, and candidates who also in the past have had tax issues as well. So my take on the whole thing is if you cannot handle your own personal finances and debt, most people have debt. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm saying if creditors are after you and you're not taking care of your business and, you know, and separately, if someone's not paying their taxes or has tax bills, how then am I as a voter supposed to trust this person to then handle the public's money? And that's my concern. And that's why I think a story like this is really important. You're not singling someone out. You looked at all council members in the Mayor John Cranley.
I did. I didn't just leave it at the one. I was like, oh, I saw this. I really looked at everybody. And I actually discovered this quite a while ago and took some time to think it through before I decided I even wanted to mention it. Mm-hmm. Then talked it through with my editors. Then spent a long time going through the court records to make sure I was correct on everything. And then finally, you know, getting together and trying to, you know, really give her a chance to respond. It all took a very long time to put together because people are like, why is this coming up now in this big, as, you know, very big things are happening at City Hall with whether we want to add all these new tax incentive districts and what's going on with an agreement with the school system. Big, mm-hmm. big issues. And people are like, well, is this a red herring? But this, honestly, this just
people need to know
to me a thoughtful way to do this story from the very time that I found out about it. It took a while to put together.
These things take time. And I know that the media is under attack and people have theories about why we pick and choose and go. Like, there's none of that. You got this story several weeks ago and you spent a lot of time vetting it, working on it, talking to people on all sides. You worked hard to sit down with Tamaya to allow her every chance to respond to this. And it goes back to this is journalism 101. This is watchdog journalism 101. This is what we do on Team Carl, as we like to call it, is, you know, we are the eyes and ears out there in greater Cincinnati local government and local politics. We are about holding public officials accountable. We are about watchdog. And this is a perfect example, a perfect story that exemplifies that. And again, people have a right to know: is this candidate who I may or may not vote for, but is on my ballot, is this person going to manage my tax dollars in a logical way and to the best that they can? And to me, a story like this tells me, it makes me raise questions whether this particular candidate or elected official is going to do that in the best way possible.
I will say, I'm not going to weigh in on that, obviously, since I'm writing about this story.
Yeah.
I mean, councils function. You know, the city has like a $412 million operating budget that council votes on. They have you know, $1 billion if you look at MSD and all these other
and capital
funds
budget and
that they really have to look at. And there's been a lot of talk recently about making these outside agencies accountable for their spending and, you know, what they're doing with the money. And so, I mean, the things are very money focused over at City Hall, as they should be. I mean, I feel like I follow the money all the time. That's a huge part of my job. And so that is what their job is. I mean, yesterday at Budget Committee, it's on my list of things to do to add up the actual amount. But they approved just millions and millions of dollars of, you know, tax breaks for all of these projects, transformative projects that are coming around for the city. And that's what they do. Money.
And you know, I think I'll expand that a little bit. And I had to, because I had a conversation with someone the other day about campaign finance. And when a candidate, we were talking about Steve Chabot and his former campaign advisor, Jamie Schwartz. I was in a conversation with someone about it. And we were talking about like how, you know, voters view when a candidate has campaign finance issues. And it was much the same way. It's like, hey, these are important to report on and point out to voters and the public and readers. Many of our voters, because it shows whether you can trust this person to, or is this person going to have problems with money when he or she then gets elected to office? And, you know, how is this person going to manage his or her office if they're elected? And so all these things, it all goes back to following the money. It's so important as in watchdog journalism and accountability journalism. And you've done that here, and we're doing that. We continue to do that. And I know that I got a big, big year coming up. And like you said, not just on the election scene, but business goes on at the Hamilton County Administration Building. Business goes on at Cincinnati City Hall, even though there's no city election. There's certainly some countywide
elections.
There's not?
Oh, sorry, that's in 2021.
I know. Oh, my goodness, thinking about that already. That is just right around the corner, and I know we're probably going to start to hear more and more candidates pop up here in the next few months for 2021 as we're trying to get going in 2020. I neglected to mention, is there anything else that you want to add?
I'll be interested to see if anything happens. You know, if the state wants to take a look at it, they can do that on their own and look at the records, or somebody can make a complaint. Those things are not public record unless for very political reasons. Otherwise, you know, they could be wielded as a weapon of like, that's a complaint. And so they're pretty much on the down low. People, if somebody were to file one, they're welcome to share it themselves. But in general, these things are quiet unless an issue is found. So I'll be interested to see if anything happens with that. But I just stuck to the facts, and that was the premise there.
Speaking of political, now reminds me of the question I wanted to ask you. Any thoughts on, from a political analysis standpoint, because you not only cover the government side of City Hall, you cover the politics side, because they all very much mesh in together. Any thoughts on how an issue like this could impact Tamaya Dennard as she maybe looks to run for re-election on council, or maybe runs for mayor, or even runs for another office here in the next few years?
I mean, I think that as a reporter, you can't change what you're doing based on this, but in today's world, you're very cognizant of the idea. Things are used in attack ads, of course. I won't pretend otherwise. I mean, I've talked about it before on this podcast and at speaking engagements. I think, you know, when I was writing a story about Avtab Puravel's campaign finances, you know, I saw that as like a transparency story. I did not, you know, they were used very heavily in advertising that I myself was targeted with the ads. And I just saw that a lot. And it was used in, you know, very, you know, pointed attack ads. Yeah. And, you know, that in particular, it does make me think about that going forward. It doesn't change what I do, but I'm very aware that these things happen. And when you write stories like this, they are going to be used like that, I feel like.
Yeah. And that's just something that's out of our control. We're again, and certainly your role is different than mine, and mine is to write commentary on all these things in a public accountability watchdog way. I write what I believe, and I hold public officials accountable. I don't care who's going to use what. That's not what I'm here for. That's not what you're here for. We're here to tell the truth, and we're here to, you know, watchdog and hold these folks accountable. as I've said like a million times now. Anyway, let's completely switch gears from the seriousness of politics and government and in the city, and let's now shift back to what we've been doing here recently, sort of in the holiday season since Thanksgiving, and that's bringing in you know, sort of getting away from politics in our guest segment. And bringing in folks who are who are in their busy season in the entertainment world, and in the we had Kurt Reiber from Free Store Food Bank. So folks who are in busy mode here at the holiday season, who are serving others and doing things that are helping people and bringing joy to
part of our community.
Very much so, Sherry. I want to kick this to you and allow you to. You're the one who's done the interview, and I want to kick this to you and allow you to introduce our special guest today, Victoria Morgan.
So I'm so excited to actually get a chance to talk to Victoria Morgan today, creative director over at the ballet. You know, when you see these ballets, it tends to be like, well, these are the dancers this time, and here's the story and the costumes and the wardrobe. But there is just one of the most brilliant minds behind that. We are so lucky to have her. You know, she came to Cincinnati in 1987, and she's now in her 23rd season. And she became director in 2008. And it just, she just has brought so much joy to the stage here in what she's doing, in particular with her, you know, version of the Nutcracker that's just been so wildly hailed. And so I want to talk to her about all of those things and just kind of, you know, she's really about empowering women. And she always has been this, but she is really kind of putting that into her work coming up for this ballet season. And so these are the kind of things we're going to talk about this time. So here, let's kind of just, she's here. Let's get to the guest right now. Welcome, Victoria. All right. So the Nutcracker is starting on the 19th. It's your opening night. And so thank you for coming in.
A pleasure. Thank you for asking.
I know. I
delighted.
Feel like it's
always delighted to talk about the Nutcracker.
Really busy time for you.
Yeah.
So how many years have you been doing the Nutcracker?
Me personally, I started when I was about 6. I did every single female role imaginable, from, you know, an under Mother Ginger skirt to a little girl in the party scene. Of course, I had the wonderful opportunity of being Clara and Snowflake, and moving on to Flowers and Spanish and Arabian, and then finally Sugar Plum.
Did you want to be a ballerina?
I did. From about the age of 12 on, and actually that's fairly typical. That decision happens early because of the physicality and the it's like learning a language in a way. Like the pointe shoe and the use of the pointe shoe is something that requires kind of a long time finessing. And people say, oh, gosh, seems like it was painful in the beginning. Yeah, it's a little painful. And I had braces at the same time. I thought life sucks. But it was, you get so familiar and so comfortable with the options and how you can play with that and how you get to turn on point. It becomes not exactly like a bedroom slipper, but something that you just feel very comfortable and molds to your foot.
When did you pivot into the creative director side, knowing that you wanted to choreograph?
You know what? I started choreographing while I was still dancing. I danced with San Francisco Ballet for about 10 years. And sort of in the middle of my tenure there, I started, we would do special events, like it was somebody's birthday or somebody's going away. Or so it started out informally. And then I started feeling a little more structure around it when I was getting a little closer to retirement in my early 30s. And it's always kind of been off and on. After I retired, I worked with San Francisco Opera for almost 10 years, and I choreographed for many opera companies around the country.
What brought you to Cincinnati?
The job, artistic director.
My job brought me here, too.
And I'm grateful. It's been an awesome time.
What did you think of Cincinnati when you first were like looking at a job like the Cincinnati Ballet? Mm-hmm. And what year was this and what did you think of the city itself?
So I was interviewed early in 1997. And of course, there were a couple things that I knew. I knew about Mapplethorpe, as everybody does.
Yes.
And I also knew that the Cincinnati Ballet was one of the very first ballet companies to get permission from the Balanchine Estate, i.e. the New York City Ballet, to perform Jewels. And I was very impressed with that. That is one of Balanchine's, like, full, it's a non-narrative, but it's a full-length ballet, Jewels, which includes emeralds and rubies and diamonds sections. And I was very impressed with that, and so I was excited to be considered.
Did you think, like, moving from San Francisco to Cincinnati?
I thought about it, but
I was coming from a smaller place where I was very excited. To me, Cincinnati was a big city.
Yeah, I tell you, I was born in Salt Lake City, Utah. I was raised very, very straight, strict Mormon family. I had to be a little rebel to really pursue my passion for this art form. And people say that to me all the time. And actually, I was officially born outside of Salt Lake City, Utah. My first early years until I got into high school, I was born in Bountiful, Utah. And what I say to people who say, don't you find it extremely conservative here? I say, you have never been to Bountiful, Utah. That is the definition of conservative.
I mean, I've definitely learned that when you're from a place, you know more about it. Because when I tell people, oh, the Midwest or Cincinnati, people don't understand what a thriving, you know, really, especially with our art scene, since you're sitting with me. I mean, we're so lucky that we have a ballet of our own, an opera, our playhouse, the Shakespeare Theater. We are so rich in arts, and I think we take it for granted for a little bit because tickets are on sale for this or that, and we just take it for granted that it's at our fingertips.
I know, and actually that was one thing that really attracted me as well, because I realized, oh, I have recordings done by the CSO, and I realized that, you know, there is such richness about the arts here. I loved that side of it.
How have we in Cincinnati, our ballet, mm-hmm. been able to thrive in, you know, ballets in general? I mm-hmm. think they're struggling a little bit. We saw the Cleveland Ballet, mm-hmm. you know, it did close, which is just absolutely stunning. Of course, it's a bigger city than us, and they're getting back up and running, mm-hmm. but they're not mm-hmm. what they used to be. Mm-hmm. And so how have we been able to really sustain this?
You know what? I think that the art form of dance is something that is applicable on so many levels. I think sometimes companies have a tendency, and I'm not calling it sidetracked, because I think it's really important what you put on stage, how you inspire your audience. For us, it's a combination. It's a blending of, you know, more the classical and / Disney kind of full-length ballets that really bring in the young people and expose young people to dance for the first time. But it's also about the contemporary work. We have a resident choreographer, Jennifer Archibald, who came through the Alvin Ailey School. So her background is not only ballet, but it's also hip-hop. She has a unique way of blending those two genres in a way that is exquisite and fierce. You know, our women even look fierce in her movement. So I feel like we're finding links to that next generation. We're finding ways to have a different kind of conversation about this art form. But it's not only on stage, it's also what can we bring to the community that no other organization can bring. We have high caliber training, our Otto and Buttock Academy. We have this extensive education outreach program. We're in almost every third grade class in the public school system, and we are have this wonderful program called Cincy Dance, which is really for young students, mostly Title I supported schools. We're in 38 different schools. We have 2,400 students, and we offer scholarships that if they get through that first year, we offer 40 scholarships a year, they are entitled to a lifetime scholarship. So we're starting to see the makeup of our young dancers shift a little bit. We're starting to see more inclusion. And I think that the beautiful article that you did about our ballet moves, the you know, the ways we can touch people's life through this art form is really magical, and it's really important.
That was a special story for me to cover outside of my wheelhouse. As you all know, I cover City Hall, and don't worry, I won't stop. But, you know, I had heard about this program through, I'd written a lot about, you know, things that were going on with the West End and with the ballet being located there. Then I kind of like, oh, well, there's all these great ballet stories. And Ballet Moves is a very special class for children with disabilities, and it just means so much to them. And I was like watching dreams come true, like the Saturday class over a series of Saturdays. It was very special to watch.
Yeah.
And I know all the arts organizations are doing like kind of unique things like that, but to see it up close and how much it matters, it does seem like you're making ballet dreams come true.
Yeah, on every level. I mean, it's so, when I go to that class on Saturdays, I it's joyous and it's tearful at the same time, because you really see young people. They are literally stepping out, and they are trying things that they've never been able to do before. And, you know, it's so interesting. Young students who are, for example, Down syndrome, they're very, very flexible. And so it's wonderful. We have a great relationship with Children's Hospital. We make sure that we're really introducing movement in a way that is very thoughtful and appropriate. And so for them, it's more about building strength, you know. And I think what happens is, and I've read a little bit about it, but, you know, for example, Parkinson's. So when you have that, the therapy is often about, okay, how do you stop that shaking? But if you move, the energy and the synapses of how the nerve endings link together shifts, and so you can actually sustain a movement without shaking, without even thinking about it. So there's, and you know, there's so much to explore in that category, and because we can, and because dance changes lives, we can make that happen.
Well, the ballet does have two huge things kind of simultaneously going on. I do feel like we should. I mean, I invited you here. I'm very much in the Christmas spirit. And like, I'm like, no, okay, the Nutcracker. You know, we had John Morris Russell from Cincinnati Pops on last week. And it's like, you know, it is the holidays. But of course, you have very serious things going on. Yeah. The ballet, of course, is moving. And you have somebody, you know, a huge philanthropist in one of the largest gifts to the arts, kind of out of the blue. Can you tell me about those two things?
Yeah, so I have to say, you know, we've had a longtime relationship with Margaret and Mike Valentine. And it started, I would say, almost the first sort of major gift was for this new Nutcracker back in 2011. That was sort of our first kind of introduction and getting to know each other a little bit. They sponsored the costumes for the children for our Nutcracker, our brand new one. And I think that the more, it was mostly with Peg, you know, she, for some reason, this art form is, interestingly enough, a lot about women. Because it's unique. It's something, for me, when I was growing up, it was the only athletic thing that I could do. Because right now, you know, everybody has soccer, they have basketball, but then it was really about dance. And there's something about the beauty and the grace and the physical power of it and encapsulated inside those ideas of beauty and grace. And like 70% of our audiences are women. And this really clicked with Peg. I feel like as it evolved, she also got to see behind the scenes, more about the education outreach, more about the ballet moves. She started seeing who we are and what we need. She heard our longtime conversations about the fact that we're landlocked. You know, we cannot live our mission or our vision. We have boundaries. We have a limited number of studios.
Even before the soccer stadium came.
Even before we were talking about
the facility in the West End.
Yeah.
Which is nice because of its location of where you were. But the ballet is like, it's growing. I think your family's forget the statistics off the top of my head, but I'll bring that back in. It's you're growing.
And it's so huge. It's almost every single class has a waiting list.
She did donate $10 million. She did do astounding.
That. Yay!
And I think, you know, I don't think everybody knows her name. I got to know her a lot, of course, when I was writing about her.
Sure.
But I think people know her without knowing her. The Valentines gave to the arena.
They did. At the University. They're very involved with UC.
Cincinnati. And she also founded the first scholarship for female athletes there. And it's like that kind of, it's big philanthropy for the university, but it's just not something you see all the time. Like a $10 million donation to the Cincinnati Ballet, that's going to make headlines, not necessarily starting that scholarship fund. So she had been giving for a long time.
It slowly went up through the years. And you know what? I think she also recognized the need, but she also, with the timing, realized that she could be inspiring. Like with that gift, we knew for sure we could make this thing happen. We could bring it to fruition.
Because you are moving. Tell us that.
Yes, yes. So we are going to be moving. We'll be moving right there in that sort of triangular piece of land, which is just off of Elsinore and between Gilbert and 71. And we're excited. I mean, in a little over a year, we've raised basically, where are we at? 21?
Almost 22 million.
We're at close to 22, just under 22 million. And that was in just a little over a year.
In this community, private donors are very important to our arts. Big cities, do have these huge philanthropists that are these billion-dollar, foundations and everything. In Cincinnati, we just really rely on certain people to give.
It's a lot about individuals. It is. It's been huge, and I've been so touched by the generosity. I also know that a lot of our, parents, and we have a young clientele, a young group of people. And so for many, many of those donations were the biggest donations they've made in their lives for this particular, I mean, there's a lot of passion behind it. And I'm just so grateful.
It does. I've seen renderings of it. Of course, it's larger and it's going to allow you to expand. It
seems nine studios from 4 to 9.
It seems like it's going to be very much a part of the skyline of the city where it's located because it's up the hill a little bit.
Yes, yes. We'll be right there with just down the hill from the museum and the playhouse. So we'll be like just part of that arts community. And there's a big evolution happening there as well. So I feel that it's easy access from 471 or 71. It's easy to get downtown from there. I mean, it's a beautiful location, actually.
Okay, so we are very much in the Christmas season. And
okay,
it is
let's
Nutcracker.
Try to get
so
back to Nutcracker.
I feel like the Nutcracker is part of many families' like Christmas tradition to go to that.
Yeah.
And so, but you are really the vision behind our version of the Nutcracker. All Nutcrackers are not the same. I learned when I saw your first one. It's so visual. Can you tell me about taking what is something super classic that everyone's so used to and making into really just this stellar review? I mean, it drew praise from all over the country and world when you did this. Tell us about creating this.
So I had been watching our previous Nutcracker, which was done in 2001 by Val Canaparoli, who's a very established national and even international choreographer. Beautiful job. And sort of typically, it can be quite formal. Like, for example, when the young kids and the families, when it's time for them to get their presents, they line up and they walk in time with the music. They bow, they curtsy, they get their present, and then they go off to the side. And it's all very formal. And this is just an example that kind of is thread all the way through my version of the Nutcracker. So for us personally, our family, we would maybe sleep in until it was 2 a.m. If my parents were lucky, maybe it was 3. And then we'd dash downstairs and we would just like wrapping papers flying everywhere. It's like it's chaotic and joyous and sharing and see and look at this. And so my version had more that kind of feeling about it. And I would say in general, there's kind of a sense of humor. I feel like sometimes people feel, oh, this ballet, it's kind of esoteric. But it's so many different things. And it can be joyful and silly. And I hired a magician to come in and help me create magic for the Drosselmeyer. And there's funny stuff that goes on in the Arabian dance. There are two women, one man, and the two women are really vying for this guy and kind of jealous and mad at each other because sometimes one is winning and the other one isn't. And so there's a lot of, you know, humor, and there's a lot of just playfulness and funness about it.
I think you had a very special guest last year. Is that right? Somebody that we all know and love. You had a.
Are you talking about Jean Robert?
Oh, yes. I know that he made a cameo. I wasn't, but that description applies to him as well.
He was our chef once in a while.
Did Fiona come visit?
Oh, yes. And Fiona. So, yes.
The description applies to both.
Oh, my gosh. Indeed. Fiona has been a part of it. And because she was so integrated and because our audiences seem to love it, she's back.
Oh, yay. I think we're breaking news here.
Yeah,
so,
great.
But, you know, where do you come up with your ideas? Do you, like, come up with them in the middle of the night and write
sometimes,
them down? Or
yeah, sometimes it's the middle of the night. And actually, for this Nutcracker, it was years and years of watching the past one and thinking, oh, I kind of like to do this with that moment. Oh, I'm thinking more along the lines of something like that. And it's interesting because you watch a Nutcracker for a long time from 01 to 2011 with our new one. It was sometimes hard to get outside of what I had always seen musically. But I really wanted it to be fresh, and I really wanted it to feel new. And I wanted especially young people to get a kick out of it. And so that's why we included the poodle.
Oh, so we have a very special guest here. And it's honestly, I know this is my favorite part of the week right this minute. When you came to visit, you brought with you Cammy,
yes.
the sweetest little dog. He's being so good. I feel like he could teach my dog lessons. So how is that? Do you bring Cammy with you all the time?
I do. I take her to work every day. And I think, you know, when I was thinking about this Nutcracker, I also was thinking about how actually important pets are in our adult life, of course, but even more so in the life of our childhood, our youth. You know, it was a big dog, actually, a dog who looked like Lassie, a beautiful collie. And I remember having like long conversations with Lassie, his name was Jetty Boy. But I remember feeling like I had a consistent and a really, you know, that love that just doesn't
part
stop.
Part of your life.
It's like part in of your my heart, life. Yeah. And so I was thinking that could be important to others, you know, the idea that there is this little imaginary creature, a little poodle that is a part of the adventure. You know, she goes to some scary places. She goes to a battle scene with some scary mice, and the poodle is defending her. And when we talk about what are things that happen in this Nutcracker that just doesn't happen in any other Nutcracker, you know, it's really the poodle who distracted the Mouse King so the Nutcracker could win the battle. And I also converted, there's...
Which is exactly what your dog would do, by the way. I mean,
she would
the
totally
FedEx
defend
man
me.
Is the biggest threat to the house.
Total defense.
It's a lot of barking when that happens.
Absolutely.
Yes, that is what our dogs do for
that's
us.
That's what they do. They protect and they give us company and comfort. And so one of the divertissements in Act Two, which is, it's called Merlitons, and that is usually a, sort of a French sort of rendition. Sometimes there's a shepherdess, and it's very sort of lovely and balletic. And so this, for us, we call the Merlipoos. It's a group of dancing poodles. And it's kind of hysterical. There's four women and one man. And it's some of my favorite choreography And it's a really hard little piece to do. We changed it up. Used to be that the extra was a woman. It used to be all women. Now it evolves. It evolves, and I'm really liking what it looks like now.
Oh, so. What does your rehearsal day look like? You squeezed us in, I know. What is a rehearsal day right now at Christmas time?
Yeah, it's busy. We have an hour and a half class to warm us up, to prepare us for the rehearsal day, to make sure our muscles are ready for what is going to be required. And then we have 3 hours of rehearsal. We have a lunch break at 1:45, and then we go back. It's 1 hour. We go back for 3 more hours. And so it's about a 7.5 hour physical day on your feet.
Is it like that for every ballet when you're practicing for it, or is the Nutcracker something that takes a little bit of extra?
Well, I think Nutcracker is challenging. I think the thing that's different, it depends on if we're talking about a mixed rep or a full-length ballet, because this Nutcracker, all the corps de ballet, all the second company, our professional trainees, everybody is working hard. The snow choreography for the corps is very, very difficult. High stamina. We've been working, doing bits and pieces of it to build for the final stamina, to really be able to do those big, tough jumps at the end. I change sections every year because there are some strengths that some dancers have, and I think, oh, let's focus on that, and let's give them an opportunity to show what they can do. So it keeps evolving, and it needs to. We have 14, 15 shows every year, so it can't just be that it's going to get boring or that you're going to be, oh, I've just done it before. No, it keeps changing. You keep pushing. You keep driving. And I'm just so proud of where the company has come to with it.
Okay, so it does start on the 19th, and how long does it run?
We actually run beyond Christmas this year. Our last performance is December 29th.
Everything falls so crazy. It's worth that one weekend's missing beforehand.
Yeah,
it's making everything more difficult.
yeah, but it's just a great thing to do with the kids, and it's entertaining and beautiful dancing, too. It's not just, oh, let's be slap happy. It's really stunning, difficult. There's wonderful classical movement, and some of it is, you know, verging on more contemporary look, but it is, it's a really important part of who we are and what we are, because this is, you know, you ask any dancer, or any of our professional dancers, where did you first fall in love with this art form? They saw it. They were first on stage in the Nutcracker.
I can remember going to the Nutcracker when I was a little girl. We did go to Cleveland, and I'm from Youngstown, so the Youngstown would have ballets come in.
Yeah.
I do remember that.
It's big in around. It's a national phenomena.
There's still tickets available.
Yes!
I think I heard, coming in here. And so people can buy those. Is it Cincinnati Ballet?
Yeah, it's. You can go on the website, cballet.org. C as in cat.
Okay.
cballet.org.
All right. Yeah. So then there's still plenty of time for after Christmas, too. Tell me real quick, before I know you have to go, but tell me real quick, other ballets that are coming up this season?
Oh, yeah. So the beautiful epitome of, you know, when you think of ballet, what do you think of?
Swan Lake. Absolutely, actually.
Yeah. And then we have another wonderful series coming up, you know, I've put a focus on women, so there's a great group of women who are a part of this year and have been maybe for the last, I don't know, 7, 8 years. Annabelle Lopez Ochoa is doing a new work. It's new for us. It's called Bloom, and it is driving hard. There's 12 men who really rough it out, who look awesome technically. We're doing another piece by Val Canaproli, who I mentioned earlier, who's it's 5 couples based on Ibsen's plays, and so it's like it, and it's told from that very Victorian woman's point of view. And there's some struggle in there, and it's an interesting statement about today as well. And at the end of the season, I mentioned Jennifer Archibald. She's got one of her, like, fierce, gorgeous pieces coming up. We have an Israeli choreographer, Minus 16, which is... We did it one other time, and the audience was so crazy about it, we had to bring it back. And so
I do think that's part of it, like bringing things back. People are like, I love that. I want to do this again.
Yeah.
And like, even though there's so much new all the time.
An opportunity to see something that you really loved and see something else, because you always will. You come back and you think, oh, wow, I totally forgot about that. I think I was looking over on that side of the stage.
Yeah. All right. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you
and
so
for
much.
Bringing Cammy. I don't feel like you're going to leave Cammy, but you can. And to all our
what
future
do you think,
podcast
Kim?
Guests, you can bring your dogs.
Thank you.
All right. Thank
A
you
pleasure.
So much.
Thank you so much, Sherry.
Sherry, you did a great job of that interview. I was here in the building and I stepped out and just said, hey, you and Victoria, go for it and do your thing. And I loved listening to it. It was awesome. This has been a fun kind of few weeks here as we've kind of broken away a little bit from politics. Certainly given our
She brought Cammy with her. Like, it's so sweet.
That's great. And any closing thoughts on and the ballet is just they just do fantastic work and the Nutcracker is it's not so Cincinnati but the Cincinnati Ballet is Nutcracker so Cincinnati
exactly
I'm trying to think it's just so awesome.
I spotted that so Cincinnati moment this morning and honestly when I saw it I thought oh Cincinnati it's in a good way but you know it's just. At the banks, they announced this morning over at the banks, which we talk a lot about politically, but also there's, you know, things to do there for families, Carol Ann's
Where's
Carousel. Right outside your window. They are in January. They're just really going to amp it up. They're bringing in snow. They're going to make snow.
Really?
And just to make it a winter wonderland down there on January's, on Saturdays in January.
Where are they going to put it at? One of those concrete parking lots down there?
Stop it. 50.
One of the unfinished buildings.
What's the holidays, Jason? So, 50-foot long snow tube ramp. There's going to be a sledding hill, horse carriage rides, hockey contests. And, you know, this is, I think, as a child who grew up in Youngstown, up in the snow belt, it is a frustration. Every time it snows, it's like, is it going to be enough to go sledding? And just honestly, it basically never is anymore. I can think of just very few times where I've gotten to take Jack sledding and just go outside with these huge snowmans. I mean, we're just always cobbling it together. That little snow we had the other night, people were outside making snowmans and posting them on social media because we're like, okay, we have a little bit of snow. Let's do what we can here.
Our very own Bro Love.
He did. I saw that.
And built an awesome snowman. I mean, literally, it looked like he was out there. He must have gotten out there right as the snow was coming down and started building this because I looked out and thought, man, it's only been snowing an hour. And then I look on Facebook and Burl's got a full-fledged snowman. It's almost as tall as him.
So just the idea that we're going to be able to do that in January. Like, if you're an Ohio child, you're supposed to go outside and go sledding in the winter. That's just a thing. And go outside and play in the snow. And the banks is just going to give everyone an opportunity to do that. But that's a very Cincinnati thing. Like, we're just going to make it happen.
Is that going to be at Smale Riverfront Park?
It is. Oh, no, I think it's right in the banks.
It is. Okay. And when is that going? Do you know when is that going to start?
And Saturdays in January.
Saturdays in January.
Yes.
Snowpalooza down at the banks. So another fun thing downtown to add to.
I think you just named it. Did you just name it? Snowpalooza?
Snowpalooza at the banks. And another fun thing, winter thing downtown that goes along with what's going on at Fountain Square with the ice rink and all that. So fun times to be downtown in January. Anything we can do in this town to make January and February fun, I am all for it because it is such a miserable time of the year around here. Not as miserable as it is in Youngstown or Cleveland, but
true story.
You know, Phil, I haven't done this in a while, but I think it is very appropriate to bring it back this week, and that would be our
So Cincinnati
moment of the week. More like this is our So Cincinnati person of the week. And none other than 25-year-old Patrick Kaplan, I hope I'm saying that right, who completed the incredible feat of eating 1,000 cheese conies in the year of 2019. His goal was to do it by December 31st. He finished it up on what, December 15th. I think he can get to, I think he can get another 200 in by the end of the year.
You know,
congratulations.
Did you eat 1,000 cheese conies this year?
It's so funny. I started to think about that. I'm like,
and just not
wait,
count.
If I just hadn't counted, how many have I eaten? No, and I really actually don't hardly ever, I rarely eat cheese conies. I usually do four way.
When was the last time you ate a cheese coney, Jason?
Well, as a matter of fact, it would have been about an hour ago. Burl, which by the way, where's Burl? I missed Burl's Christmas party last Friday night because I was out of town. He was nice enough, though. I don't think he did this just for me, but he did this for the office because he's always thinking about the team. He brought in, he had a coney bar at the party.
He did. It was awesome. There.
And he brought in the extra conies into the office today, and so I got to enjoy that. And it was like fresh conies.
Wait, you know what? Honestly, it's such good party food. The party planner, our own fabulous Lisa Gillespie, who keeps this office running, no joke, totally. If you have a problem, she's going to solve it. She did a lot of the party planning, which is the fun part of her job. I think the part of her job that she doesn't like dealing with probably is Jason and I, my time card, and Jason and I's expense reports, probably.
You may call that party food. I call it lunch and dinner.
Okay. But it was, you know, it was just, that's exactly what you were looking for at one point. So there was some fancy food, and then that bar was very popular.
But anyway, shout out to Patrick Kappel, Xavier alum, who I guess saw a headline in the Inquirer, what was this, a few years ago, where someone had, a man had eaten 400 Skyline cheese conies, and he thought, I'm gonna set a goal on top that. So congratulations, Patrick, I guess, right? I mean, is that?
I mean, that's your party story for the rest of your life. Guess what I did one time?
Yeah. No, I think it's pretty awesome. I'm not sure other people might
think that, but
I think it's pretty neat. So, Phil and Sherry, we probably should try to get Patrick on the podcast. I think his feat is certainly worthy. That certainly fits That's So Cincinnati. And we should try to get him on as a special guest here soon.
I agree with that. I actually, to be fair, I have a lot of questions. I didn't read the whole story, which neglectful of myself, but I do have a lot of questions about, like, when you get, what number are you like, oh boy. Do you ever doubt yourself that you can do this? Do people, like, encourage you? What does Skyline think when you come in there? Are they all from the same Skyline? I have a lot of questions. He has to be a guest.
Do you like Skyline chili? Have we talked about this?
We've talked about this.
And?
It's took me a bit of time to get on board, but I like a cheese coney late at night occasionally. But it's how you know I'm not actually from Cincinnati, I think.
You know, I'm not from Cincinnati, as we know, but I freaking love Cincinnati-style chili and love Skyline. I love Gold Star. I love Price Hill chili. I love Blue Eye chili. I love it all.
I mean, to be fair, I'm wondering if there's still any left from the leftovers.
There was one left when I grabbed my second cheese coney of the afternoon.
All right, fair enough. Okay. I missed it. You have to get to the food quick in this office. True, that's true.
I wonder if we went back to the entire year and what 3 months we've been doing this podcast, if you just took out the clips of how much we've talked about Cincinnati style chili, if that would create an entire hour long episode. Probably would.
Definitely. That seems like a feat for Phil to try and attempt or not.
Phil is just smiling and shaking his head no. Silent Phil on the ones and twos, that is. Anyway. Merry Christmas. We're coming. Stick with us.
Because yeah.
Holidays or not, vacation or not, That's So Cincinnati podcast is there for you. We will be back next week. We are not missing a week at all, just like we didn't last year. We're not missing a week of episode. Next week, we will have a special year-end episode. Going to be a little bit of a shorter episode. But certainly it'll be a fun year-end wrap-up. And then the following week, I'm really, really excited about the New Year's edition or episode of That's So Cincinnati. And we have a fun thing planned for that. So stick with us. Tell your friends. Don't forget those all-access digital subscriptions. Can't thank everyone enough for going on, and you know, supporting local journalism and buying your subscription to Cincinnati.com and The Inquirer. And am I done rambling, Sherry? Do you have anything else to add before we?
Nope, I second all of that.
Sounds good to me. For Sherry Coolidge, Silent Phil, I'm Jason. Wishing everyone a Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays, and catch you next week.